This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Yes, the economy is growing, and yes, that's good. Mostly. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the first day of July somehow, if you can believe it. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Our entry into the business and economic news of the day arrives to us via the Congressional Budget Office, which delivered an update to its 10-year budget and economic outlook today. As always, with CBO reports like this, there is lots in there that we will get to in due course, but we begin with this. The CBO figures the economy is going to grow at a real rate of 6.7% for the year. Real just means after you adjust for inflation. And 6.7% would be a lot, the best annual growth in almost 40 years. With growth, though, and growth is, to be clear, a good thing, but with growth come some less than desirable side effects, one of which is rising energy costs. More use, higher prices. The basic formula there, of course. Crude oil today, the U.S. benchmark West Texas Intermediate, up 2.4% today, over $75 a gallon at the close. And if you've got a gas grill in your backyard, you might have already noticed propane prices are up. That's retail, right? Propane futures are basically twice what they were a couple of summers ago. Marketplace's Andy Euler, down in Austin, Texas, had a look-see to figure out what's going on.
Last month, Mitch Leff went to REI to pick up a couple of cans of propane before taking his scouting troop camping. What he found was an empty shelf, so he asked an employee to look for some in the back.
She came back with four cans in her hand, and I said, okay, I'll take two of those. And the lady who was standing next to me said, I'll take the other two.
It was the last four cans in the store. And the price?
I want to say it was at least 20% more than what I was used to paying.
Now, why the price spike? Well, one, we're exporting a lot of it overseas. Two, that freeze in the middle of the country down to Texas led to more consumption of propane and less production in February and March. And three, oil drillers in places like the Permian Basin just aren't pumping as much right now. And because a lot of propane is produced as a byproduct of crude oil refining, there's just less of it around. Nico Safos at the Center for Strategic International Studies says it's not just propane. Fuel prices more generally are rising.
The simple explanation is the economy is picking up again, and the supply system is not responding quite as quickly.
Now, limited supply and more expensive propane is an inconvenience for people like Mitch Leff and his troop. But Lauren Ross at the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy says for many folks who live in rural areas, propane is what keeps them warm in the winter.
Many of these households will have to make trade-offs, properly heating their house, keeping their family safe, versus other necessities like food and medicine.
The Energy Information Administration says folks in the U.S. should expect to pay almost 15% more on propane this winter than last. And that's only if temperatures aren't colder than forecast. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Item two in our energy and power segment today turns on this news item. New Yorkers got emergency alerts on their phones yesterday, asking them basically to turn off the air conditioning if they didn't need it and to use less electricity. The weather, apparently, back east has been brutal. You have heard probably about equipment in Portland melting in its heat wave this week. Just last winter, power grids in Texas, down where Euler is, failed spectacularly in those storms they had. So Marketplace's Sabri Benishore set out today to talk power grids and a warming planet.
It's getting hotter and hotter for longer. The weather is getting more extreme.
In general, I would say grids are not prepared for climate change.
Brian Taroja is a researcher at UC Irvine. Higher temperatures mean higher electrical demand, says Michael Craig, assistant professor of energy systems at the University of Michigan.
And if you're not planning for that increase in demand, which many systems are not right now, then you are not building enough capacity to meet that future demand.
Utilities traditionally have based their future plans on the temperature extremes of the past. Those are no longer reliable, says Arnie Olson with Energy and Environmental Economics.
You know, 114 degrees in Portland was not on anybody's radar.
A lot of utilities thought they had time and are now playing catch up, says Craig.
Utilities are in a bad position because things are happening very quickly that many people did not expect to happen so quickly.
Priority number one is protecting the infrastructure we have, says Taroja.
Weatherize our infrastructure against these kinds of extremes.
Power companies will need to build more sources of energy, and regulators will have to allow them to be built. Taroja says the more diverse and renewable the energy sources, the better. Having lots of little interconnected sources of power and storage will help too.
When you have microgrids and energy storage and distributed solar and things like that, you have more levers that you can pull to make sure that the electric load is met.
In some areas of the country, like in Texas, grids aren't well connected to one another, meaning power can't easily be moved to where it needs to go. Craig at the University of Michigan says utilities are going to adapt in different ways.
Many of them will build storage and renewables, which is great, but, you know, a lot might build more gas plants.
Overall, Taroja says everyone knows what needs to be done, but not everyone is doing it. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Here's another item from that CBO report, inflation for the rest of the year. Using the Federal Reserve's preferred measure, something called PCE, personal consumption expenditure. I'm pretty sure we've gone over that. The CBO says inflation's going to top out at 2.8% this year, falling back to 2% in 2022, which is, I think, sorry, just checking my J. Powell dictionary here. Yes, no, it is. It's the definition of transitory. On Wall Street today, ain't nothing going to hold those traders back. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I think it's in the Marketplace style guide that we can't let more than 2 days go without a supply chain story. I kid, but that's kind of what the news feels like, right? So let's talk cars here for a second. You know about the chip shortage, which has forced Detroit to temporarily stop or slow production of a lot of models. Not great for the companies, obviously. Not great for consumers. Also not great, though, for the people who actually make the cars, as Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports.
The U.S. auto industry goes through a lot of ups and downs.
It's very cyclical, and it's subject to things like supply chain issues.
Michelle Krebs at Cox Automotive says because of that,
unfortunately, auto workers are rather used to this roller coaster ride of having jobs and then being laid off.
People who work at the big three Detroit companies, Ford, GM, and Stellantis, formerly Chrysler, are pretty well protected from that unpredictability because they're unionized. Kristen Gcheck at the Center for Automotive Research says there's a provision in United Auto Workers contracts that if your plant is idled, your employer
will make up the difference between the unemployment that you get from the state and a large share of what you would have earned had you been working.
And often the layoffs are temporary. Andy Challenger at the outplacement firm Challenger Gray and Christmas says that's the case now. And the automakers are making sure their employees know it.
Because there is an overall labor shortage occurring right now, too. So there probably is some concern from these manufacturers that those people will go out and find new jobs in the interim if they keep them on furlough for too long.
Shutting down plants that produce the F-150 for too long would be a big deal for another reason, says Kristen Gcheck at the Center for Automotive Research.
It's a really big deal to shut down pickup truck plants. Shutting down pickup truck production means shutting down profits.
And that could affect employees, too, because they get profit-sharing checks.
And those are, you know, they've been enormous, you know, 8, $10,000, $12,000 a year for a number of years now. That'll be a hit to personal income for workers who get profit sharing.
And she says a hit to the local economies where those checks get spent. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Marketplace Morning Report, three words. That's the call out. Check it out. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says whole hog prices were up earlier this year on higher demand as we all started going out again, which makes sense. But ag, as you know, if you listen to this program, is a global business, and it ain't just the U.S. of A that matters. So as we do with all things hog-related, we called Brian Duncan. He's the vice president of the Illinois Farm Bureau. He raises hogs and farms corn and soybeans himself as well. Hey, Mr. Duncan, it's Kai Rizdahl. How are you, sir?
Good, Kai. Good to talk to you again. How are you doing?
Good to talk to you. Why don't you go ahead and hit that little red button? We'll get this show on the road.
I did. I'm ready to go.
There you go. All right. You're a step ahead of me. So listen, let me just jump right in here. The reason we called you was because of a headline we saw in the Wall Street Journal the other day, rather, that goes like this. U.S. hog prices sink as China rebuilds herd. And I said to myself, we got to talk to Brian Duncan.
Well, I guess I'm your go-to on this issue.
You are the hog guy. So I mean, look, there's a lot to talk about. But first of all, the prices you're getting in market for your hogs, how are you doing business-wise?
Prices are pretty good right now, Kai, actually. We've had a really good combination of factors, some good domestic demand along with exports like you just referred to. You know, there's quite a bit of uncertainty, though. You know, China's always a wild card. And then the next question is, do you believe anything they're saying about the rebuilding of their hog industry? And then we've also got this whole issue with line speeds and a judge's ruling in Minnesota that's going to slow us up. So it's a pretty tumultuous time. We're trying to hang on to some profits.
Is that the line speed thing is literally how fast they process the hogs? Just give me the 30,000-foot view here. Is that what's going on?
Sure. There's a new inspection system that went in place for moving hogs through the harvest facility, which is good for producers like me. Good demand.
Right.
But a judge has looked at that system and said they didn't take into account all the factors that should have been. Hmm. But anyhow, now it's a political football, Kai.
Yeah, I bet. Let me ask you a couple of sort of ancillary questions. Number one is weather. I understand you guys have been having a drought up there, and farming's tough in the best of times, and I can't imagine doing it during a drought.
Yeah, I'm in the northern part of Illinois, and we are very dry. We had some good rain Father's Day weekend, but that's about it. If the hot temperatures would stay abated, you know, and we sure don't want that dome they've had out in the Pacific Northwest to come over the Midwest, I'll tell you that.
Yeah. Okay, so item number two is sort of domestic demand. As people get back, are you seeing demand for ribs and, you know, all that good stuff that comes out of your hogs?
Yeah, we are, and the food service has come back online, and all of a sudden they start stocking up, right? And ballparks, I mean, full capacity at Wrigley Field. You know, that's a lot of hot dogs they need all of a sudden. So as we see things come back online, pork is positioned pretty competitively priced in the meat case. And we all know, Kai, bacon's a bargain at twice the price. So
yes,
demand is good.
All right, but wait a minute. Are you a Cubs fan?
Yes, I am. All but right. Boy, after those last six games, I'm not so sure I'll claim them, but I'm afraid I am.
Yeah, it's a little tough. A little tough for Cubs fans right now. Okay, last thing, and then I'll let you go and let you get back to work, Mr. Duncan. How long do you think, and I'm pretty sure I've asked you a variety of this question at least every time over the past, you know, year and a half or whatever. How long are you figuring till you can look and say, you know what, the pandemic is done and my operations on my farm are back to normal?
That's a great question. I thought it was going to be pretty soon here. You know, you're always a little nervous and you don't want to take things for granted. But I think once we get over this demand surge now of restocking, I'd hope by the end of summer, things will have settled into what is a sustainably profitable time period for all of agriculture, not just the hog industry, but all of us.
Brian Duncan. He does hogs and corn and soybeans, I think, as well, up in northern Illinois. Also the vice president of the Illinois Farm Bureau. Mr. Duncan, thanks for your time, sir. I do appreciate it.
Kai, it is always a pleasure to talk with you.
Coming up,
growing our own pair of jeans.
A STEM study, perhaps. Get it? STEM, science, technology, growing, jeans. Oh, never mind. First, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials found 131 points today, 0.3%, 34,633. NASDAQ picked up 18 points, about a 10%, 14,522. The S&P 500 up 22 points, 0.5%, 43.19. Construction spending fell about 0.3% in May. That's according to the Commerce Department. Housing construction, though, still posted a 0.2% gain. Lumber prices, been talking about that a little bit, have been dropping pretty fast as supply has come back. So, home builders, D.R. Horton nailed on 2.7%. Beazer Homes lifted 3.1% today. The weekly unemployment insurance claims figure continues to decline. We've been tracking that pretty regularly as people lost jobs during the pandemic. 364,000 claims filed last week, a decrease of 51K from the week before. Just for comparison's sake, comparable week last year, 1.4 million first-time claims. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Venture capital is a key part of the circulatory system of this economy. People with money taking a chance on new companies and sometimes losing their shirts, but sometimes being ridiculously well rewarded. That much of the story you know, probably. What's less well known is that VC is notoriously lacking in diversity. About 72% white in the United States, just 4% or so black. Marketplace's Amy Scott has the story of a group trying to change that by turning to historically black colleges and universities.
On a recent morning at Morgan State University in Baltimore, a small group of friends were chatting about their summer jobs.
I was up till 4 a.m. last night working on a financial model. Like, they sent off 2 term sheets last week.
And so I don't know about you. This was not my summer job experience just after college. But these three, Ime Essien, who's in the last year of a master's program, and recent graduates Kylie Williams and Toby Plumpter, have already had significant experience in venture capital. Essien is interning remotely with Redpoint Ventures, which is based in Silicon Valley. When Plumpter asked him what companies he was looking at...
The term sheets are not signed, I can't disclose what the company is.
Top secret stuff. Essien got his internship through a nonprofit called HBCU VC. Its goal is to develop a new, diverse generation of venture capital leaders. Chelsea Roberts is HBCU VC's chief operating officer.
There was just a huge market opportunity to go to HBCUs because that's where Black talent is, and that's where Black talent has always been, right?
She says while companies like Google and Goldman Sachs recruit at some HBCUs, venture capital traditionally hasn't.
VC firms, if they are doing any campus recruiting, are going to Columbia, Penn, Harvard, and Stanford, I'd say, which is a big reason why the industry is so insular.
Students in the program learn the foundations of venture capital and have access to the group's million-dollar lab fund to invest in startups. Kylie Williams heard pitches like this one from a recent Morgan grad.
Hi, my name is Victor Yarioko, co-founder of Your Convey. And Your Convey is a safe app that makes it easy to ride with people you know.
We did not give them funding. The team wanted to see more traction, loved it, but thought it was just a tad bit too early for us to give funding. But that was an awesome experience.
This kind of experience lets fellows develop a track record of investing, which venture firms and their investors like to see. After the fellowship, Ime Essien says he now has a built-in network of support, including Chelsea Roberts and HBCU VC founder Hadia Mujahid.
HBCU VC is a family. Like, we deeply care about each other. Like, it's Auntie Hadia and Auntie Chelsea. Like, that's how it is.
Cousin Chelsea. Chelsea's 27, for what it's worth. HBCU VC was founded to create the same kind of network for Black and brown college students that many white students have. Venture capitalists tend to invest in entrepreneurs they know or who know someone they know, often from the same college they went to. Again, COO Chelsea Roberts, a.k.a. Cousin Chelsea.
The culture of historically Black colleges and universities is so much so rooted in relationships and networks. If we're understanding venture as an industry, being a relationship business, that already exists at HBCUs.
So far, the program works with 15 of the country's 102 historically Black colleges and plans to expand to more. The hope is expanding the pool of funders will also diversify who gets funded. But some are skeptical about how quickly the industry will change. Jim Gibbs is a Black founder who raised $2.5 million for his parking startup, Meter Feeder.
Do I think that they're going to change? No. They're not going to change until there's a consistent stream of success stories. That's when the quote unquote venture are going to venture into the safe bet, like, hey, I'm going to invest in these Black and Brown startups.
For those paving the way, it can be daunting. Kylie Williams was one of two Black women interning with the Baltimore-based firm Squadra Ventures.
Like, we're on the website, we're like, wow, this is a very, 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 very white company. Like, and at first, it's a little bit nerve-wracking, but it was very clear that they were putting in extra effort to make sure that we're a part of the team.
She says she had a good experience, but if venture is going to compete with other industries for talent, it might have to recruit a bit earlier. Williams is starting a job at Goldman Sachs this month. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Climate change and the pandemic have delivered kind of a 1-2 punch to a lot of companies, obliging them to cut their carbon footprints and at the same time shorten up and strengthen their supply chains. Textiles and clothing are among the industries under pressure, all of them, but textiles and clothing especially. A small pilot project, though, in the northwestern British town of Blackburn, once the center of the global textile trade, offers a low-key solution. From Blackburn Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that one.
Last year, this small patch of land between a busy road and a canal was derelict, covered in refuse, old mattresses and rusting metal. Today, it's a neatly fenced field of luxuriant green. And, says textile specialist Justin Aldersey-Williams, it's the scene of a groundbreaking project.
We're growing flax for linen and woad for indigo dye with the aim of growing our own pair of jeans in Blackburn.
Woad once grew right across this country. Ancient Britons daubed their bodies in its blue dye in a vain attempt to scare off the Romans. And, says clothes manufacturer Patrick Grant, before the arrival of cotton, flax was very widespread here as well.
It's a fantastic plant because it doesn't require any irrigation, it doesn't require any pesticides or herbicides, and that is why it's such a fantastic crop for making clothes from.
Linen is natural, he says, unlike most of the oil-based synthetic fabrics used in today's clothes, and he claims it's incredibly hard-wearing.
Of course, you used to make sailcloth out of linen, so it's a very durable fabric, so we're developing denim-like fabrics.
Grant and his colleagues aim to grow, harvest, spin, weave and dye one pair of jeans from this field by the fall.
What's the point of all this? Where are you heading, potentially, with this?
We're trying to demonstrate that you can make clothes completely locally that cause no harm to the environment and do it in a way that's economically sustainable.
The pair of jeans will be put together here in Grant's small clothing factory about 2 miles up the road from the field of flax. Jenny Rutter, who's also involved in the project, hopes that that one pair of jeans may lead to a string of local growers, spinners, weavers and dyers.
Do you think you're ever going to be able to compete, though, with mass-produced textiles?
Well, probably never in that kind of scale, but I think there's a real market for it now. You know, for clothing that's more sustainable and more ethically produced and that has more local supply chains. So I think there's a real opportunity for that now.
The idea is certainly popular. Dozens of people volunteer to clear this field for the flax, and many are ready to turn up every Friday for a spot of pulling up weeds. Among them, Zara Shatima, Claire Saville and Aisha Siddat.
It's going to be great, and to see it from start to finish to a fully formed garment, hopefully, at the end, then it's a fascinating process, yeah.
When I heard about this, I just thought it was fantastic and I really wanted to get involved. So Friday's my day off, so I was more than happy to come and be a Friday flaxer.
On our doorstep, and we're making denim jeans. It reminds you of what Blackburn used to be.
No one seriously believes that Blackburn, the beating heart of the Industrial Revolution, where 70% of the world's cotton textiles were made, is about to see a renaissance. That would be pie in the sky, spinning a yarn indeed. But the organisers of this experiment believe there could be at least a small niche industry in the making here, an industry that can only grow. In Blackburn, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today. Yes, there is that other story out there playing hard on cable news and everywhere else as a political story. We, however, beg to differ, remembering as we do that the guy whose name is on the company famously said while he was running for the job that he used to have that he's the king of debt. That's a quote, king of debt. And so with his company heavily indebted and now indicted, we got Campbell Harvey, a professor of finance at Duke, on the phone, and we asked him what happens to all that debt now.
On the announcement of indictment, it means that the debt immediately becomes riskier and effectively falls in value.
And so?
If you're going to resell that debt to somebody else, if one bank wanted to sell it to another bank, then the price would be substantially haircut.
Haircut is what the corporate bond people say when somebody is going to lose a lot of money. Campbell Harvey there helping us out from Duke. All right, we got to go, but here's your moment of economic context super quick today because I talked too much already. Last item from the Congressional Budget Office, the federal deficit is going to hit $3 trillion in fiscal year 2021, second biggest since World War II, behind only fiscal year 2020. That's right. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Beth Perlman, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.